All right, Rodney, welcome to the podcast, man.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here. Good to be here in Michigan. It's really, really good. Really good to be started talking about, you know, social emotional learning, how we can improve the lives of students. You know, my mentor has this thing where he says we should make it a goal to restore hope, rebuild dreams, and save lives. So I really think that's what the goal of transformative education is about.
So I'm really
excited,
man,
to do it.
Well, I'm excited to have you here. I think that for everyone listening, what's always great is a little bit of context. Who is Rodney Walker? You're a world changer, man. We met at Arkansas Conference. You were keynoting. I was doing the breakout. I walked in and you started getting me crying, man. What the heck? I started literally tearing up and getting so emotional. And I sent an email to my team and I said, this guy is, he's our people. He has our heart. He's gifted, he's talented, and if he's not already speaking around the country, which you are, we want him to be a part of our team. We want to, let's bring him in. So tell us a little bit about who you are, where you grew up, where you live now, a little bit of, give some context.
I have the privilege of being able to be a speaker and a, you know, consultant around the country, different school districts, nonprofit organizations. It really stems from really a culmination of experiences that's put me in this position. So I take a lot of joy in learning that I can do it. I mean, it stems from my mentors over the years who've kind of put me and primed me in a position to do what I'm doing, but it also stems from, I guess, my own personal life experiences and building the resilience that I have today to kind of help me move forward in that direction. So my basic blueprint is in foster care in Chicago. So I came into foster care at 5 years old. I was in the foster care because my father was incarcerated for selling drugs. And so we went into the system shortly thereafter. My mom lost her parental rights early. She also grew up in Chicago's public housing. And they both lived this incredible life of dysfunction. They both had the DNA for literally like that self-destructive kind of nature going forward that put them in a position to be where they were. My mom, you know, didn't have a father in her life until she was 12, and then he, you know, sexually abused her. She had a mom who had her at 13 years old. In fact, my great grandmother had my grandmother at 13. So when my grandmother had my mother at 13, it was kind of like really fluid for my mom to be in this situation that was so subconscious in that regard. So she was out in the streets a lot, you know, had her first child at 13 years old. And so like that kind of continued the way that it did. But beyond that, just her microsystem was so adverse, given that she grew up in, you know, around poverty that didn't seem like poverty to her because it's all she knew. She grew up in a poor education system. She grew up in Chicago, but Chicago in the 50s, 60s, 70s, which is Chicago at that particular point was really struggling with this integration piece in terms of how to support African-Americans who had did the whole migration to Chicago. My mom's side is from Arkansas, actually.
Really?
So
wow, so that was pretty historic, having you keynote at the Arkansas.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah, a couple hundred districts there and hearing your story.
Yeah, my people from Lone Oak, which was just outside of where we were at in Arkansas. And so when you think about how, you know, these public housing units were really like systems of upward mobility before African Americans got to this place, and then it became incubators for poverty and social failure because the political infrastructure didn't have the necessary resources, the understanding, even the compassion to be able to understand that sojourn in that way. My mom literally became like, she came in this vortex of all these different dynamics in play. It wasn't
I hope everyone can capture what you're saying. It's so colorful.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, like,
it's so colorful what you're saying.
Yeah, I get...
I think we want to make it so simple, but it's like, it's actually all connected. It's like there's budgetary, everything, there's connected actions, and there's the politics. There's,
It's everything. It's a whole...
systemic.
It's systemic,
therapy,
right.
Systemic change, systemic transformation.
No one particular thing can be blamed for the dismantling, I guess you should say.
And really quick, just as a... So you, this is what you've done, some of your research and studies at Harvard.
Well, this... My research in my family came before Harvard, but the existential nature of it really came at Harvard. It was really me studying the complexity of it.
And just trying to understand. You were just trying to understand. You were just trying to look. You were trying to...
Right. You know, like as you get older, you look at it as more of like a one-dimensional problem. And then obviously as you get older, you become more learned. You see it as more of a multi-dimensional problem because that's exactly what it is. It's, you know, it's like, you know, you put ice in water, it doesn't make it cold because the ice is in there. But we're like, you figure out like what makes ice, how what the temperature is. It's like, right. What kind of, like, you know, you have to understand like all those dynamics. So it's just like that. Cool. With my family. So I say all that to say, from a background that in the foreground, my mom came into a situation that was beyond her control when she made the decisions that she made. And my dad the same way. Now, when he went to Vietnam in 1968, his life had, it was literally merging post-traumatic stress disorder with an already dysfunctional adverse lifestyle.
Oh my gosh,
right?
Man.
So it wasn't.
And in an age where PTSD wasn't as well, like it wasn't talked about as much.
Absolutely.
Necessarily,
yeah. In the 60s, like it wasn't talked about at all.
Right.
So you talk about heroin, cocaine, which was just, it was this very fluid transition from Vietnam to one of the major ports in the United States, which is Chicago. Mm-hmm. That influx of drugs from that area to this area was just so fluid. So mm-hmm. you couple that with veterans coming back home who know now how to use it. That was my dad's reality. So
right.
It wasn't just that he had a disposition to trauma, and so he knew coping mechanism in the form of heroin.
It was a multiplier of five different things. And
it was also his father not being around, so he didn't have a real male father figure. He grew up in public housing with a lot of, you know, like gangsters and hustlers and pimps. So they, you know, they didn't really have that orientation either. So my dad didn't care. He did what he did. He didn't apologize for it, and he made all these decisions early.
But to your point, it's like, you know, when your reality is your reality, you normalize it, you rationalize it. You don't even normalize it. It's so subconscious. It is normal to you.
Exactly.
That is what normal is.
Right.
So I want to pull back really quick. We're doing this podcast. Let's talk about trauma-informed instruction, mm-hmm. how trauma impacts adolescence and learning. So I want everyone to have context. Your story is a part of something that's not just a great story, but it's also connected to the research that you've done. It's also connected to countless research that's done all around the country, all around the world, around how trauma affects and impacts learning.
Right.
So I think that some of this is going to really come out to where hearing your story, the pieces are going to come together on how do we help individuals like yourself, as well as all the other individuals that have trauma in their life. I've heard this one, I don't know if it's a podcast or blog, that everyone has trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's, you know, micro trauma, it's trauma to them. Like, there's trauma in everyday life is what this one kind of concept was
if
around.
If you ask everyone, just ask everybody, no matter where they are, one question. What was the worst day in your life? And everybody will have a story.
Right. And that is trauma to them.
And that is trauma to them.
Right.
Even if it's micro trauma. Mine's like, okay, I got pulled from my home when I was 5 years old and I got sent into foster care. Yours is the day my mom died. The day my dad died. Right. Didn't matter that you grew up in a household with two parents and that you had good resources and you had a good environment. The day your mom died is a day you'll never forget.
And there's kids that their mom never died. There's kids that, you know, their girlfriend broke up with them. And then
you
learn that those individuals took their life. Right. Death by suicide. And it's like, whoa, this person had a good family. This person. Right. So there's to your point, there's all these extremes.
Right.
All these different avenues.
Right.
So keep going with your
story. Trauma-informed education is unbiased, unfiltered. It happens to the best of us. It happens to the worst of us. It's just, and so there is a science to trauma-informed education. That's broadly defined. We're only focused on at-risk youth and students with high ACE scores in my particular situation, because it is literally like, it is the layers on the ground that they are the layers on the ground that needs to be focused on. Right. It's
right.
Like you have,
there's a statistical significance in specific like groups connected to ACEs scores. But I think what we're learning is we have to get everybody.
Absolutely.
Because everybody then can help everybody in
right.
the process as well.
Right. Yeah. If you help at risk youth, then by default, you help everyone else, because what works for them has to work for the kid who's literally like in suburbia, who is struggling with academic success, who has post-traumatic stress disorders by default of that. But if you tell them you can give me ingredients that work for a kid in foster care, and then you can actually use those same principles and apply it to someone who's struggling with academic success,
the competencies,
then it will work by default. Exactly.
That's it. The strategy, there is a core component. It's like social emotional learning works for all humans.
Absolutely.
It may work differently, like responsible decision making or
right.
relationship skills, empathy.
Right.
How we deliver that, yes, but the core print, I love that. That's really good. So you talked about your mom, you talked about your dad. Keep going, like, what else? Kind of like, catch us up with where you're at now, you've kind of, how you escalate that story really quick for us.
So from the time I came to foster care 5 years old to the time I aged out at 18, I was in 12 different foster homes.
Wow.
So from 5 to 17, I was in 12 different foster homes.
And your brothers and sisters?
I have 6 siblings by my mom and dad, but I have 10 total.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them are dispersed across the city of Chicago in different situations, but all have that same shared experience with, you know, dysfunction in some type of way, shape, or form. Whether it's just like parents going through divorce, the whole drug addiction, growing up in the city of Chicago with all those elements. More or less, we've all had that experience with adversity. So mine just looked like 12 different foster homes, some modest, some compassionate, others very abusive, very neglectful. Didn't really understand that dynamic. Then when you compound that with a financial infrastructure like the foster care system in Illinois that didn't pay you enough but paid you just enough to stay in the system and do what you were doing, made it extremely compromising for foster caretakers to do what was necessary for young people.
Right, they're motivated by compassion, but at the end of the day, then they're realizing, okay, we actually need this money and we're getting just enough to get through, but not enough to maybe treat this individual, this human, exactly how we need to service them with whatever else they would need. So you're 18, then what happens? You're going to school.
So I'm 18. I'm
going to school. High school, quick, rough high school conversation.
So yeah, I didn't care about high school at all when I was in high school, probably up until my senior year of high school. You know, the only thing I cared about post-teenage year, that eighth grade, ninth grade year, when I like actually had those hyper emotions connected to my cognitive and social development, is where the hell is my family? I need to go back to my family. That's all I care about. So grades,
you talked about that in your story. Like that was the core component every day.
Right.
You would deny your reality. People say, well, yeah, no, where's my family? Mm-hmm. I just want to get back to my family. Yeah. You were locked in on that.
Absolutely. Violence, poverty, social failure is all a manifestation of one thing, and that's a broken family. And that was true about my story. Mm-hmm. I didn't do good in school. Obviously, I didn't show up to class often. I was sick. I was always, you know, going through some type of physiological ailment. And it's all because of this one thing. I was stressed and depressed.
Manifestation of your stress and your, right. And body does weird things to stress. You know,
absolutely.
That's very true.
Yeah, it was terrible. Something even worse happened in that when I went to high school, I got back in touch with my parents. 17 years old, just turned 17.
Wow.
They looked great. They're just in my perspective. They were still, you know, struggling with drug addiction, but they looked great. So I ran away from my last foster home and I went back to my parents.
Got it.
And the police came and got me. And then that was like a horrible event day in my life because then they locked my parents up. And then I went back to my foster home and I was told by my foster parent, like, no, you can't go back there no more. So I ran away again. And then when I ran away again, you know, the Department of Children and Family Services had me sign a waiver that waived away my independent living and scholarship rights to college.
Wow.
In return for being with my parents and aging out early.
Whoa. They had you waive. I don't understand that.
Yeah, I had to sign like As a 17-year-old, yeah. I had to sign an indemnification agreement and non-disclosure waiver.
That said that I am not going, I'm waiving my ability. If I go back to my parents, I'm waiving my ability to go to college and have any type of
supplemental support from the Department of Children and Family Services. So I didn't get any independent living benefits.
Did you even understand what you were actually doing then, though?
Nope.
Like, I'm just thinking of a 17-year-old, like, you're like, all right, whatever, I don't care. I want to see my mom and dad. Blah, 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 and you're
That's
like,
exactly what I did.
And then 5 years later, you're like,
I'm taking out $25,000 in loans in my first year of Morehouse College.
And there's no taking that back.
No. No.
And you went to Harvard. So it's like,
eventually I went to Harvard. Yeah.
There's no.
So,
there's,
you know, but you could have told me that, oh, well, if you do this now, 7 years, you'll be at Harvard. Like, no, I didn't know. I did not know. Right. Yeah. All I knew was that.
Or you could have said, hey, you're going to go to college and you're at 17 years old. And you're like, no, I'm just going to like do whatever I'm doing to make whatever I'm making to do. You're right.
Right.
Well, when you're in that mode, there's surviving, there's existing, and there's thriving, right? Most of us are in survival or existent mode. Very few of us are in thriving mode because it's kicking every cheat. It's relational, financial, emotional, social. Thriving is kicking everything in gear, having everything in its equilibrium. And that takes a lot of time and a lot of energy.
Absolutely.
A lot of maintenance.
Yep. Before I got back with my parents, I was literally survival mode, right? Like, it's like me waking up trying not to kill myself every day because it's like someone was telling me I couldn't have what I desperately wanted. Right. Then when I got back with my parents, it was more like
And let's say this too, what you desperately at that point potentially felt was your human right.
Right. Absolutely.
Which is fundamental to the human psychology, which I think we forget some of these things. There's these fundamental, like, you wanted that, but it's also potentially felt like an injustice to your human rights. Like, right. It's your mom and dad, and it was probably very hard to understand cognitively, like, everything that was happening. It's hard probably to put the, I mean, I can't even imagine putting the pieces together.
Right, right. And my parents, you know, to that credit, like, they only knew what they knew, right? And the system probably was looking at me and saying, like, this poor kid, like, he doesn't understand the dynamics involved. Right, the way I know him now, right? Yeah. I know him now.
And each piece has its own story, right?
Right.
We get it. It's this, the way that you solve dynamic problems is with high levels of impersonal objectivism.
Absolutely.
Which means you're not emotionally connected to the outcome of anything. You're connected to the outcome that's best for everyone.
Right.
And that's very difficult in a world where everyone is so hyper-emotional and we all have social platforms where we can express our opinions and ego gets involved, where it's hard to solve these very dynamic problems. So let's talk about after high school, and I want to dive into really how social-emotional trauma, because everyone knows social-emotional learning. Mm-hmm. So I think let's talk about, because you're married now, I want you to kind of catch everybody up, where you live, all that. And then I want to talk about the difference between SEL, social-emotional learning, and social-emotional trauma, and how that impacts learning.
Okay, so. Absolutely. So right out the gate, when I got back with my parents, I became extremely motivated to be successful in life. And I think that was like the cusp of thriving, even though I didn't know what it meant. So when I joined the mentorship program and the entrepreneurship program, the merge of these two became literally like the winning formula for me, because it allowed me to break down where my parents were and where I was socially and emotionally from all those years. And then it allowed me a blueprint to go forward in a proactive and constructive way. So entrepreneurship says,
wow, you don't just drove your purpose.
Yeah.
That gave you a purpose.
Right. Trauma-informed education says, you're going through a lot, but let's be resilient. But entrepreneurship education is saying, don't just look at where you are and survive it. Look at where you can be and thrive in spite of where you are right now. So that's kind of like the merge of these two created everything that I did after that. So
wow.
I said at that particular moment at 17 years old, yes, I'm back with my parents. I don't care about, you know, forget about DCFS and I'm like, you know, all that. And then I'm like, I came down from that. Out of all the hype, I'm like, oh, yes.
Reality hit.
Yeah, and then I'm like, okay, now where do I go?
Now what do I do?
So I look around. Now
so you
I'm
got what
I'm
you really always wanted. Around. You got what yeah. you always were fighting for. And then you're yeah. like, now what?
Yeah, exactly. Now I'm really looking around like, oh, my God. Okay. So then I look to the left and it's like my mom and dad struggling with drug addiction. Then I look to the right and it's like my neighborhood is struggling with poverty and gang violence and gun violence and, you know, homelessness and alcoholism and things like that. I'm like, well, damn. Then I look at my grades in school and I have like a 2.1 GPA. Like, I'm never going to get into college with a 2.1 GPA. The minimum is like 2.5, oh. right? It's like D's and F's in my first 2 years of high school. You know, I didn't have enough acumen, enough internship experience, enough exposure, whatever. So I get to applying to colleges thinking like, okay, well, this is no big deal. It's like too many colleges to me to get turned down from all of them. And I got turned down from all of the colleges I applied to.
How many did you apply to?
Come on. I applied to 13 different colleges in the first 2 months of high school, in my senior year of high school. And they all said, you know, you need a minimum of 2.5. So just wait until after your first semester and see if you can do anything really different.
Wow.
And I was like kind of devastated. I was like, I just probably got to work.
So you're just hitting these walls though, right? It's like wall,
a lot of walls.
Wall,
right.
Wall.
I did not have any forth thinking after I got back home. It was just all about getting back home. I wasted literally so much time and space just doing that.
So what's the difference between social-emotional learning and social-emotional trauma?
So social-emotional learning is helping young people to establish emotion regulation to a point where when they get to adverse experiences and obstacles, they understand the process of emotion. That's social-emotional learning.
And that's teaching them self-management, self-regulation, self-efficacy.
Self-efficacy, empathy, inhibitory control.
So it's actually, it's social emotional skills.
Absolutely, yeah.
At a basic level, okay.
It's learning how to be sociologically and emotionally competent with the world, irrespective of adversity. It's just that when it just matters because in the context of adversity, they understand the process of emotion.
It's a general basis, a general training for social and emotional skills taught for people. So
absolutely.
The difference of that between social emotional trauma is?
So the difference between that and trauma, social emotional trauma is the impact of adverse experiences over time. So I'll give you a great example of this. Social emotional trauma says that your parents got divorced and you didn't know the process of emotion regulation and inhibitory control.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't understand executive function, anything regarding, right. in regards to that. And so what happened is your social emotional processes is starving to understand it, and it doesn't, and therefore it goes into an adverse loophole. So therefore now all your decision making in life is based on this one critical event or series of events that your emotions has not been able to process,
whether by default trauma. You have or have not learned social emotional skills.
No, it's actually an absence of social emotional skills. So in other words, if you learn social emotional skills in advance of whatever adverse experience,
you're less likely to have social emotional trauma.
Right.
Which is emotional trauma and social trauma, if we want to break it up and be very specific about it. Which right. Social trauma can create emotional trauma can create social trauma
right.
between our relationships. I'm yes, I like this. This is strong.
Yeah, is that I'm just making sure that
this
makes sense.
This is very clear.
So take 5-year-old Rodney in foster care. Mm-hmm. Right. This any impact that early is more than likely going to create social emotional trauma, no matter even if you learn emotion regulation as early as 2 years old.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's a good point.
We have elementary schools that's literally teaching kids very, very early what it means to be sad, what it means to be happy, what it means to be excited, and how to actually process those emotions in a very productive and proactive way, right? In the elementary way, but very proactive and productive, right? Yep. Oh, your dad didn't come home tonight. Oh, how do you
feel?
How
did that make you feel?
I feel sad.
Self-awareness.
Oh, yeah, it's a really
So what do you
really
want to do about that?
Right.
Self-management, responsible right. decision-making.
They're, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Right, and then the information around that dynamic helps you reconcile, because it's not just about processes, it's about reconciliation.
That's it, man. Right?
Oh, okay. My dad didn't come home. I feel sad about it. I got to do something with these sad feelings. Oh, but wait a minute. People leave sometimes. Like, this is what they do. And so sometimes they come back and sometimes they don't. So a reconciliation piece is saying, oh, well, you know, this isn't the first time this is happening. And actually, this is the normal experience in relation to everything else. It's saying in the elementary way, but it's getting kids to understand that and feel that reconciliation very early mm-hmm. so they can process it proactively going forward. That doesn't happen early, especially with a lot of kids in public school. So what you're left with is trauma. That's what you have. It's like seeing your mom struggling on drugs. It's just seeing your dad incarcerated. It's not growing up in a house with your father and seeing all these adverse experiences in your neighborhood.
Which, so basically,
and
you
not knowing what that is emotionally. You
how
say,
that's impacting you. You're right. not even consciously aware of how
no.
it's impacting you.
It's subconscious and sub-emotional.
And then we're like, oh, Rodney's not doing any good in his grades.
Right.
Well, you know, it's because he has trauma. It's a social-emotional trauma.
Right.
So this is my question is, like, for those that have social-emotional trauma in their life, and when we identify that, they are actually, we should be putting them on a path for more social-emotional learning engagement. Because
Absolutely.
They need those skills even more to process cognitively, emotionally, socially what they've been through.
Absolutely.
And just really quick, too, one jab on this.
Mm-hmm.
The reconciliation piece, we haven't been talking about it enough, like our organization. Personally, I think it's the number one piece.
Is
personal reconciliation, reconciling with yourself,
mm-hmm.
the decisions you've had, the thoughts you've had, the things you've said to yourself, the things you've said to others, reconciling with yourself and reconciling with your mom, your dad, the world around you. I think without and because of the lack of reconciliation
Absolutely.
And the ability to say our piece, which is really around restorative justice, which is around restorative practice, me restoring mm-hmm. myself, I think that's why we even see higher increases of trauma. You can't heal your trauma, and this is a spiritual act, that you can't process your trauma
right.
if you have not reconciled.
Absolutely.
I really believe that.
And you'll find me saying this a lot, that it's one you can feel however you want to feel about whatever you've been through, but at the end of the day, it's going to come down to the choice, no matter what. There's no way to avoid the choice.
The choice of what?
So the choice of what do you do in light of what this is.
Right.
There's no
Which
other
starts
way.
With stages of grief. It starts with
Absolutely.
Acceptance, and then
right.
it moves into anger, and then it
right.
moves into denial, and then it moves into bargaining, and then you're like,
right.
the only way to exit the circle, you never leave it. You only go to acceptance.
Absolutely.
And as long as you stay in acceptance, you can surrender it. And it's like, and mm-hmm. a lot of times accepting it is socially allowing people to accept that this is who I am.
Absolutely.
Which we haven't gotten there yet. People
okay.
haven't gotten yeah. to the place, right? And tell me if you agree. People haven't gotten to the place where it's like, Rodney, I like you, but I don't want to hear your story. It kind of makes me it makes me nervous. I just teach math, Rodney.
Right.
I'm just the principal. I don't open that can of worms with me.
Right, right.
It's accepting people.
And you can kind of understand it in some respects, even though it's like education is evolved into that over time, right? Because back, you can make a compelling argument that in the 40s and the 50s, when really like the infrastructure was not that, teachers really were like that. They was like, you know, We can, learning this skill set makes our economy millions of dollars seamlessly. So
whatever, it helps me with my job security, my job satisfaction. And yeah, to your point, I don't blame teachers or principals or educators or district. That's what you're saying, right? Like, what I love about our conversations is we don't think that once, like, no, half of that is because standardized tests, requirements for teachers and what they are required to do. We have, from a structural standpoint, all forgotten the purpose of how we're trying to do this. Absolutely. I think teachers need more support so they can actually spend more time doing, and I think leadership, more importantly, the school leadership supporting that.
Right.
Which,
right,
I love you. We always take those sides. This isn't, we don't bash any side or any name or any partial piece of this. It's like, we all need each other in this.
Absolutely. Journey. If you have an education system, you brought up standardized testing, but if you have an education system that's literally preparing students to be efficient in skill set so that they can basically go into jobs that increase those skill sets that will improve the economy, then the education system as it stands today makes perfect sense. But we know that it's so many more layers.
It's changed
drastically.
Technology is.
Right. So now we need two schools. We need a school for cognitive learning and development, and we need a school for social emotional learning and development, because these are two totally different things. Just because you have a good job doesn't mean you know how to sustain a family. It's right. Two totally different
and
things.
If you want to actually have a good job, then you need support. And if you, the better your family is doing, the better your job is doing, and the better your job is doing, the better your family is doing. It's all interconnected.
Right.
So let's talk about how this impacts.
It just didn't matter earlier because the industrial age was so asymptomatic. It means nothing just to learn how to be a tradesman. I mean, not that it learns nothing, but it's not as complex as learning how to be a master visionary, a director, a producer. Mm-hmm. When you can just be a tradesman, you can afford to just dilute the social emotional aspect of it, because it's just about learning the trade to get income to then boost like the economy, and then everything is working great. Once money is involved in anything,
until someone has emotional breakdown,
absolutely.
Until someone's running the line at your industrial complex,
or the war is over. Now, what do they call it? They call it a Great Depression. But oppression, emotions didn't matter when the money was being made. So it's like, that's my point. Like, when the economy was thriving, this doesn't matter. But as soon as a depression hits, it's depression. So now everything that you didn't deal with, why everything was so great, now you're dealing with now. So that's the danger of like walking without chewing gum at the same time, even though I hate doing that. But that's the danger of not doing it. So
right.
This is why this needs to be separated in its own thing. Like, social emotional competency and learning could be intertwined with this cognitive and skill development, but it has to be its own priority, because that's what's really going to sustain.
I like that. Hard, so when you see the separation, I'm like, the separation only for the sake of the priority of how much we need each one,
right?
And then integrate them together.
Absolutely.
Right, because if we don't, it just becomes an add-on, and we can't do add-ons.
We can't.
No time for it. So talk to me about how this impacts adolescence and learning. How does social emotional trauma impact learning? I'm a principal. I'm a teacher. I've got all this stuff to do. I'm a district leader. I'm a coursework provider. Whoever it may be, I'm an education expert. I'm an education consultant. How does my job, how does my work day in, day out, how is it impacted by, so how are my skill, my test scores, my truancy, and how many times students show up? How is this being impacted? Learning.
Right. When you're in a space where you have social emotional health and wellness, but just in its most simplest terms, you're in the space and place of social and psychological safety. And as we know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. The only way that you can really thrive and do the things you need to do to succeed is if you're in that space of social and psychological safety. So social emotional learning relates to this in so many different ways, because you can't teach young people who are not in the space to learn. And we know that in public schools in general, rural schools in general, that when you have high populations of young people coming to school with all these dynamics of coming from poverty and dysfunction, you try to teach them the competencies they need to learn. They won't learn them, not because they don't care per se, but subconsciously they're going through something really deep.
That blinds them from the reality.
That blinds them from being able to focus. If you go to
And those teaching it often are like, well, why can't they? And it's like, well, because your level of cognition and your brain development and your life experiences are dictating and projecting your bias on the fact that this, we don't know where this to. How many times have we had our organization, I'm sure you with traveling, is, you know, we didn't know that this student was actually living on the streets. and falling asleep with them. Yeah. You know what I mean? We didn't know that until they told their story.
Right.
Yeah.
They look so well on the outside, but then when you dig deep and figure out that this they're not well, then everything makes sense. Oh, that's why they were getting C's and D's in our class. Like, this is why they were skipping school.
And until I feel safe enough with you, I'm not going to tell my story.
Absolutely.
Especially right. with the classroom of people around and the fact of their shame. And then I'm like, I'm already dealing with what I'm dealing with. I don't want to deal with you dealing with me mm-hmm. and having to restructure whether or not you want to interact with me and then deal with the rejection that I may get from you and deal with the shame and judgment that I may get with you. I'm having a hard time accepting myself.
Right.
So I don't know. We're just playing. So keep going.
That's largely an indictment on a lot of school systems, but not purposeful indictment. It's a byproduct of an indictment because it's, school systems don't start with relationship.
Right.
They start with curriculum and instruction.
But it's because they're not measured on that, right?
Right.
So when you tell me, hey, you're hiring me as a vice principal, you're hiring me as a dean, that's not really necessarily a part of my job on what I'm measured on. Let's just, right? I mean, and that's tough.
Absolutely.
So what we're really saying is it's not, we actually need teachers, principals, school buildings to help raise their voice mm-hmm. to the local federal government, to the local governments, to the federal government, in the sense of all of these different authoritative powers, to the legislators, to say, hey, if you want us to actually hit our numbers, the measurement of how we're measured has to also be connected to something more largely connected to psychological needs of humanity.
Absolutely.
Right.
That's the only way.
That's why we feed our kids. It's because if they're not fed, they can't learn.
It starts with the relation. If my first interaction with you as a student, the student to teacher interaction is you saying, why did you come late? Right? Or like, why didn't you turn in your homework on time?
Oh, my heart's breaking just putting myself in the thought process of you. You're like, and right now you're like, you're swearing in the back of your mind. You're like, dude, you don't know what I've been through.
Like, I'm never going to tell you anything.
Trust you. Yeah, right.
Like, exactly.
Now I can't trust you.
I'm never going to tell you anything.
Just like everyone else in my life.
Right.
Looking down at me thinking that I'm stupid when I've been, you know, and I get it. Mm-hmm. But then I also get, right, the teacher that had to wake up at 5 o'clock, grade 100 assignments.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. It's all connected, right?
Spilled coffee on their lap in the morning, didn't have their, and then they're showing up and they're like, gosh darn it, I'm trying to keep my job and I've got to, all right, I got to get
do
kids.
Do not have time for this, yeah.
Right. So it impacts it, you're saying, drastically. I mean, talk a little bit about what you've done with Harvard, and I think that one part is, how is it impacting learning? And then to me, it's, how do we adopt trauma-informed practices and curriculum?
Yeah.
Because this is where a lot of schools are. When we talk to schools, you and I know that schools are like, they're believers. When they hear this, a lot of school leaders are like, that you're speaking to their inner child.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And they get passionate, man. That's what I love about educators. They're stinking the most passionate people in the world. Mm-hmm. You don't get into education because you want to be a billionaire or a million. You get it because you really, your teacher made an impact. Your counselor made an impact in your life. You're a right. counselor because you're doing good back because what you went through and you didn't have the support.
Right.
So circle back. How does it impact learning? Now, how do we adopt these practices? What are the practices? Where do we go, Rodney? Right.
My sojourn, like, so basically, like, my plight to Harvard and Yale is a byproduct of social emotional trauma in respects, because I was diagnosed with autism when I was 5 years old, but my autism didn't have anything to do with my inability to learn. So it wasn't a cognitive deficiency. It was my learning deficits always came from social emotional
trauma,
dysfunction, and trauma. Right.
Yeah.
Because I learn very fluidly. So I do believe that 80% of all students in this country who are struggling with academic decline and social decline is a byproduct of social emotional trauma and dysfunction, not necessarily because they have cognitive impairments that's so great that they can't overcome those learning barriers. It's just, you know, because the brain knows how to sustain and repair itself with proper facilitation. But what it doesn't know how to, what the body doesn't know how to do is literally repair itself from social trauma unless you have that type of facilitation, which is what social emotional learning should be.
And that's not throwing computers or technology, that's throwing human beings.
Humanity, right?
Trained human beings is even better, right?
Absolutely, right? It's getting that one care in the dough or and better, a microsystem of those who refuse to see you fail, and mean that in every sense of the term. So my sojourn to Harvard and Yale is that when I graduated from high school and went to Morehouse, my main messaging from my mentors was, don't do this to just stay away, not come back to Chicago Southside. Like, get the life that you were cheated of all this time. Like, this is your opportunity to recreate, redefine, or reinvent. your space. And right. that's exactly what I did. So when I worked so hard in college, I wanted to go to a school like Yale or Ivy League just to say, like, you know, I can do anything. So I put my mind to it, and then that's what happened. I put all my energy to that. But Harvard was more about really diving deep into the social, the process of social emotional learning and trauma informed development through a human development lens. So that's what my education right. at Harvard was about. My education was in human development and psychology. So it's taking post-traumatic stress disorder and being able to like flip it on its head to say like, we can use this as a vehicle, just like how you can turn natural gas into like into reusable fuel in the way that kind of makes the environment productive and sustainable. You can kind of like create like another form of that. This is kind of what post-traumatic stress disorder, we can do for that as well. How can you get people to say, man, my life has been broken in all these different ways, but from this, we can use this and rechannel it to do something radically different and create something better and beautiful that doesn't that we could only have done with this, with post-traumatic stress disorder.
So talk to me, I'm a teacher. And then talk to me, I'm a principal or building / district leader. Mm-hmm. Where do I start? Whether I've started the path or I've not, what's your opinion on where do I start? Do I first go to a curriculum? Do I first go to a practice? Do I first go to a training? What in the heck do I do? Right.
So unequivocally, if you took away all the constraints that these type of people have to go through day in and day out, if you're talking about the actual process of mentorship, which is why I think is critical for like making this happen.
That completely transformed my life. Mentorship.
It starts with the relationship.
People talking to me and people letting me talk.
Absolutely.
And then me figuring out how to feel safe in my own social.
Oh yeah.
In my own brain, really.
It's sitting down with a kid and getting him whatever his best meal is and not giving him no expectation about it. Mm-hmm. Oh, he must be doing this for something. Oh, he must be doing this because he wants me to get good grades. Like that's the only reason why he has me in this room right now, giving me like, you know, this food that I just love to eat. Right. So all right, just let me hear it. Let me hear what you got to say. I already heard it before. A teacher already came here today and said, mm-hmm. listen, I can give you this. You know, you can have a special lunch every Friday, but you know, you gotta do this. You gotta say you sorry to your teachers when this happened. You gotta make sure you don't get in detention.
So is it practices? Right? So I'm hearing policies and practices for a school leader or a teacher. Mm. It's instead of throwing the curriculum and jumping into the curriculum, it's actually coming up with a set of principles, practices, values at the school level that mm-hmm. we follow that honors the human and has a there's a way to build processes around this. Is that accurate? Right.
Absolutely.
And there's policies and there's trauma informed instruction strategies. You know, where do people go to start finding some of this stuff?
So I think Purpose Prep is really doing a good job with being able to build these mechanisms out. In my own personal platform, I've tried to like really put together tools and skill sets to really like bring that out.
Don't you have resources and blog? Like you have stuff that's on this, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. On my website, anewdayone.org, I have a lot of information like blogs on that. I'm also releasing a book next month called Wounds You Cannot See.
Wounds You Cannot See.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
The trauma-informed approach to mentoring youth.
So this to me, I like practicality. Like if you're listening to this, Wounds You Cannot See, Rodney Walker, mm-hmm.
anewdayone.org.
anewdayone.org. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, starting if you're a teacher, going and having the conversations with the principal, hey, I listened to this podcast, or hey, I read this blog, or hey,
right.
and just starting the conversation. You know, right. There's community groups, there's teacher groups, there's Facebook groups, there's right, there's councils, there's steering committees.
Right.
If you're passionate about this and you're passionate about the students and you have this in your life or your principal or your leader and you know and you believe, and more importantly, believing takes faith. It's a lot easier to have faith when you look at the data and the stats and the research.
Right.
So, you know, if you're looking to actually make a transformation in your school, systemic transformation, it does get sustained at the home, but it starts with something.
Absolutely.
Anything. And I think if someone's listening here, these are some resources that they can do is start. What I'm hearing is start the conversation.
Right, right.
With yourself, with someone else.
Start the conversation and get the information that's necessary to be able to do it and do it effectively.
Yeah.
You know?
I think so. And I think it starts with actually coming up with, if you have to come up with 5 rules at the school, right?
Mm-hmm.
We stop and we make eye contact with our students. I mean, these are little
things. Very subtle, but very, very important things like that.
Yeah. And these aren't rules that make it harder. These are rules that remind us that in our job, we're also dealing with precious human beings that have a life of their own, a family of their own, an experience of their own. Mm-hmm. You know, it's rule number 2, we take the time, right? I'm just like this would be a cool thing. You write these out and you're like, hey, this is what we stand for. This is what we do here. Not to say that these aren't also marketing differentiators for why you send your kids there. Then
I think
start measuring the data over a 3-year period and realize that our students actually, well, you know, I took math classes.
Mm-hmm.
Not because I liked math. It's because my math teacher, man.
Right.
Mr. Sweeney. It's like he really put his hand. I'll never forget. He would put his hand on your shoulder. Man, Dan, he would always call me Dan. Uh-huh. Man, I believe in you. What's going on? Whenever I wasn't doing good, mm-hmm. whenever I was misbehaving, there was this like, I want to please him. I want to make him happy. I want to make him proud of me. So I performed. Performance comes from relationship.
Right.
Right.
I got to say this because this truly gets to the core of mentorship and social emotional learning in broad defined. If you was born in the 2000s, you probably won't remember this as well, but it's the movie Matilda is a perfect example of this.
Matilda
is a perfect example of a movie that exemplifies adoption by choice. I want to make this very, very clear about adoption by choice. If all foster care organizations were smart, what they would do is they would have foster kids come to foster homes by choice, just as like a filter. Like a buy-in process, an interest process, right? Like they have so much fun that you don't have to tell them like, oh, how about you come here? You know, your parents, need some time to do this or get this thing together. Why don't you come here and stay some time? You don't have to do that. They'll do it. Like they'll be like, I want to sign this over. I want to actually be here. I love it here. Like
that's going down.
This is great.
Deep psychology though.
We often resist
what we are told we have to do. We just resist it.
Yeah.
Like the moment, like when you have a big dream and then it happens and then you're like, yeah, you're like, oh man, I really want to speak at this thing. And then you get the opportunity. You're like, man, I just kind of want to hang out at home. And
yeah,
I mean, right. It's just this psychological, like, it's like we, I like this. Some of this stuff I think has, it's deep rooted psychological principles though, that aren't necessarily being utilized in even, again, the marketing flow, the process flow of how we, that's what you're getting at.
Absolutely. Psychology has like, it has 50% to do with the problem, right? I don't want you to come here. I don't want you to be my mentee because you're part of a program. I want you to be my mentee because you want to be my mentee. Like you, it's something about me that you like.
And now there may need to be a program, and there may need to be a school authorized, but it's how we market it. It's how we label
Absolutely.
It. It's the structure on how we communicate. You're getting, I get real passionate about because now this
because
this is what I think, we're two young individuals, but like, I think we're, old souls. I always say I'm a millennial, but I identify as a baby boomer because I'm an old soul.
Old soul in the young body.
I guess it depends on who you're talking to. Because if you talk to certain people, like my, Reed, our COO and other friends of mine, they'd be like, I have millennial tendencies. Okay. Don't get me wrong. But I say that to say like, this is never about throwing away things or throwing away systems or throwing away organizations, or we have some weird dark bias about systems and infrastructure. Actually, I'm a big infrastructure guy.
You can't grow without infrastructure.
But it's how we lead the infrastructure is relationship. And you get much more out of the infrastructure.
It's exactly my point. Like, so that you know that the infrastructure and the systems in place really are not the problem. It's more like how you impose those systems and infrastructures.
Money, you'll get better grades, you'll attract more parents, you'll get better engagement. You'll get better teachers with how we lead these initiatives.
I'm the type of person that will walk into a classroom or into an auditorium of students and parents and say, just what we was talking about today. Like, my worst day in my life is actually when I got taken into foster care at 5 years old. I never got over that. My parents are still struggling with drug addiction. Someone in my neighborhood just got shot yesterday, right? I go back home and my siblings are still struggling with homelessness, incarceration, poverty, all the social dysfunction that they didn't learn, relationships. They're struggling with all these things. And guess what? There's nothing I can do about it. And I went to Harvard, right? I hate that happened. And this will feed the post-traumatic stress disorder that I have that will never die. So the only thing we can do now is to be proactive so that the people coming up, the kids coming up, don't have to do this ever again. So when
what you're saying is your reality, just because you went to Harvard, just because you made it out, just because you finally, just because you got married, it doesn't just go away. You're still, this is your reality, period.
I'm still living with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right,
just
you have
like
to learn
80%
breathing techniques.
Of whoever, if you're talking to a classroom, just if you're talking to an auditorium or audience of parents and students, just like they're going through right now, like the post-traumatic stress disorder don't go away with a trip to Harvard. It doesn't, right?
Right.
So So we have to get proactive and real about how we psychologically and socially reprogram students to understand that your life doesn't end just when you go through a post-traumatic event.
Or when you do your counseling and you get your breakthrough. What is the breakthrough? It's a moment of awareness, but it doesn't mean that it changes the way that the fact that you still can be triggered and how you cope with triggers and how you cope with...
Exactly. Now imagine if I take that.
This is
and imagine then transferring that into saying I'm a principal or I'm a vice principal or I'm a superintendent. I go in and say, guys, we have the lowest test scores in the district. This is unacceptable.
Right.
We need to be leaders for our district, for our nation, and that's why we're going to do everything we can to institute the most efficient academic processes to make sure that your kids succeed in the real world. Me and my kids, I just got divorced yesterday. Like, what?
The teacher sitting in the room or the principal?
Yeah, you know, or like, yeah, like the parent. I'm talking about the parents or like the kids. Right. Like, I have this kid who I just got from foster care.
Well, you're He's giving awareness about, that you're dealing with trauma in everyone all the time.
Yeah.
And the trauma that you had two decades ago could still be existing in the trauma that you're having today. It could still be something that you've dealt with, but you still have as a part of your story.
Right.
So you're dealing with, yeah.
It's incredible, right. And so for as an educational leader, for you to not acknowledge empathy and compassion at the forefront of your
delivery.
Opening, your orientation, yeah. when people are sitting here and they're going through real problems in life, real challenges, like it's kind of, it sets the tone in a really, really adverse way.
Well, it makes our jobs harder too, right?
Absolutely.
I'm all about making efficiency is about as long as you can be efficient without hurting people and stepping over people and empowering people. If you can do that, efficiency is everything. Making your life efficient makes your life better. Mm-hmm. So we've literally got like 2 minutes. I want to nail one last part. Assess. Okay. I want to talk about assessing how trauma impacts our roles in schools, our job satisfaction in the school culture. How does trauma affect our job roles? I'm thinking about 5-year-old Ronnie. Well, I'm thinking about your teacher that was like getting secondhand trauma through your trauma with how she was dealing with whatever you're doing, right?
Absolutely.
How does it affect us? This is real.
Oh, it's explosive. To hear a kid come, to hear a kid in your classroom say, yeah, I'm going back home now. I actually don't have any home to go to, but you know, I'm glad to be in this class. Like, what do you do with that as a teacher? You can't take a kid in. You can't do that.
That psychologically messes with your mind if you've never gone through anything. I could say this because I've taught in 30 different countries in classrooms that literally had no electricity, that were in the middle of the jungle, to the wealthiest schools in a state. And ultimately, in every single classroom, no matter what ethnic background, no matter what socioeconomic background, whatever, when I drive home, I realize that teachers have one of the hardest jobs at the front line. Right. And I've dealt with secondhand trauma just listening to kids and their life stories. And it doesn't change. Every time it happens, you have to process it. You can't unring the bell. Once you hear it, you can't unhear it. And you got to figure out where you put it.
Right.
So how does this impact my job? And then how does this impact the way I interact with other staff?
It literally compromises your ability to be efficient across the board. You can't raise students' test scores. You can't raise their grades. You really can't even focus on curriculum instruction because of the barriers of trauma, right? You have to focus. You have to
integrating trauma-informed support. Absolutely. So that's why I'm not even making a judgment call. I'm saying, is there potentially a conversation that social-emotional trauma is also at an academic leadership staff? Like, we need to talk about this for adults as well, maybe. Potentially, right?
Absolutely. Adults first, actually, I will argue, because students are the end users. But adults are the vehicles. They are the vehicles that can really penetrate the subconscious.
So we don't jump at curriculum.
We
jump at actually training.
Right. Curriculum for a purpose. See, it's like when you're a student, I don't know, like run out of time, but when you're a student who is going through so much, you can't afford to learn subconsciously because subconsciously you're adverse. You have to learn on purpose. This is literally what purpose-driven learning means. It means that I can't afford to just be in this classroom just to be in this classroom. My mom's struggling with drug addiction. If I don't master this math test, if I don't master this English test, it's not just about math and English. It's about putting myself in a position where this never ever happens again. This is what
purpose-driven learning. So it's like, if I do want to help my mom, the greatest way to help my mom is to help myself to get good on this grade, because I want to make money one day and help. This is, and even if it's a means to an end, it's having some type of purpose behind the learning.
Absolutely.
Which is
stupid. And not to get out of poverty, by the way, but to get wealthy. Because it's not poverty. Getting out of poverty will drive you deep into poverty. You have to aim to get wealthy. That's what purpose-driven learning really is. Right. It's not saying like, my mom lives in the hood, I got to go ahead and go to college and get a good job so I can move out of the hood. No, it's like, I got to build a system of wealth and a wealth mindset to get her out of individually, the hood by default.
Right.
Yeah.
And whatever I mean, it is, it could be poverty, or it could be the fact that my mom or dad are going through a divorce, and how do I cope? I've got to have my own individual purpose, from the student to the staff to absolutely. The teacher to the counselor, social worker to the janitor. It's like, I'm getting invigorated, because I feel like what we're nailing and hitting on right now is ultimately giving people a reason. It's giving people a why.
It. Yeah, it is. It really is.
It's giving them a why.
It's the spinning wheel. I think that it's, if we can create a why for everybody on the wheel spectrum, it's
game over.
Yeah, it's game over.
That's the one reason my biggest regret when I was young is I did not realize why I was learning, and it was nobody's fault but my own. But what it could have potentially helped me more were people more adding color to why I was even learning what I was learning, right? Mm. Because I didn't know why I was learning algebra. Now, if I would have learned and just been, maybe, and this would have helped, right? Is like, you're learning this just to learn how to problem solve in life, because life is full of problems from the moment you wake up, to learn how to manage a schedule, to learn numbers, to manage your schedule in your day and how many hours. Learning why, getting your why. I love it.
Right.
We're getting into it. So, hey, this is super powerful. I think that job satisfaction, school culture, all connected to that. I think that if we can train teachers, train leaders, train our school staff, we do create a better culture, which creates a better atmosphere, which dictates how we interact with each other, which has rules of engagement and how we respect and empower and honor one another. This ultimately affects everything. This affects how we show up to work, our frustration towards each other's staff that are on a linear path, that are on a horizontal path, vertically, those are above us, those are under us, those are next to us. Man, it was awesome having you on here.
Oh man, I appreciate it.
This is sweet.
It was great.
Any last thoughts to anyone listening on trauma-informed practices? Anything you want to give as a challenge?
Yeah. One last note. Mm-hmm. I'm a visionary, and so I love to think like vision. And so by and large, everybody will agree that if you take any student who comes from poverty and social failure, and they find a way to be resilient enough and to be competent enough and to be aware enough to master their learning, to go on to advance their learning, and then to become not only just competent at what they do, but to become very skillful at what they do, that's going to generate them wealth and success beyond whatever adversity they're going through. If you take that type of individual and then you ask them at the moment of success, what is it that motivated you or drove you to get out of it, to create all these dynamics of change in your life, the best answer that they can give is not necessarily that they've been a part of an initiative that helped them to do it, but more so is that they are driven now by a deeper purpose.
Wow. Man, I'm getting like pictures left and right. Right. What I'm seeing, just so you know, is wealth. It's like, what I'm getting is wealth equals positively progressing change. So as long as you're progressing and it's positive, and it's in the areas of wealth, is not money. It's relational wealth.
Right.
It's financial wealth.
Right.
It's mental and emotional wealth. Mm-hmm. It's the areas of abundant change.
And it's on purpose. That's how I want to make sure I'm emphasizing this, because it's on purpose.
It doesn't accidentally happen.
It's like you get A's in school. You apply to colleges, not just any colleges, but the best colleges. You apply to different jobs, not just any jobs, but the best jobs. You literally spend your day researching the ways to be the very best version of yourself. And it's not because any teacher or any school system, any infrastructure on its own did that for you, but it's because literally when you wake up, you are motivated and inspired to do something radically different from what you knew. That's when you know you've done social emotional learning.
Right. That's the kicker right there. We're just trying to create the environment for that.
Exactly. Not benchmark driven. Like, oh, we got him to have a higher test score now. Right. That's great.
Or we got him to take an assessment on self-management.
Right. No, that's okay. But it's really trajectory driven, right? It's like he's making a series, or she's making a series of positive life decisions that's going to inevitably lead her to the
and
very best.
And if we have that bigger vision, right, I think actually we can drill back and get the assessment out of responsible decision making. That's a no-brainer. But if we're just thinking about the responsible decision making, we might be skewing our own data.
Absolutely. Thank you. That's what I've been trying. It's so hard for sometimes people to get that.
Short-term to long-term. I get it. You're teaching me. I'm like, yes.
Right.
Yeah. We got to do more together, man. You are absolutely changing the world. Listen, if you're listening right now, you got to go and check out what Rodney Walker's doing. You speak around the country. All you want to do is speak. He's one of the most talented speakers that I've seen. So if you're listening right now, go to the website, pick up the book, send us a message. I know that you're on social media, right? Mm-hmm. We'll put some of the links below here. And thanks for taking time, man. This is awesome. No,
thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it.